Members, we're going to get started. When I first stepped in the room, I could barely squeeze in, and I thought, well, this is great, you know, all this strong interest in K-12 education. But there's still a lot of people in the room. There's a lot of energy, so I know that interest just transfers over into another audience. Members, a couple things before we get started. And I had an offline quick conversation with our Republican lead, Representative Erickson. We don't have the minutes from the last meeting, and part of that is because we had a little bit of a confusing set of affairs in terms of, you know, amending one of the amendments that was before us. And I wanted to make sure that the minutes accurately captured what we did. And so the minutes are being worked on, and so that also means that the referral on the floor of the House for a committee that came out of here, referred to another committee, also will not be before us on the floor of the House later. But obviously, once we make sure we have the right wording in the minutes, we'll have the minutes before us, and we'll also do that motion for the House. So I just want to be very transparent and upfront with you on why those minutes aren't before us. I think we did everything correctly. It was just a little confusingly done, and I think it created some problems for our staff in drafting the minutes about, you know, so how do we actually write that out? So with that, and no, Representative Brenner, that is not at all a comment on you. I mean, that was just, you know, it was our first amendment moving this year, and, you know, it's not unusual for committees to sort of get their feet underneath them as they move ahead. We're going to get really efficient and effective at doing this in the coming weeks. So with that, members, we've got a couple of things before us. It's going to be a little, packed, I think, in our agenda, but I think we want to make sure that we have good time for quality testimony. We do have some people from from Greater Minnesota have come to testify, and I want to make sure we absolutely get to them later on the bill before us. But before then, I have the privilege to welcome Mr. Steve Pruitt from the Science Technology. Well, actually, I don't think that's the right name. I'll let him introduce the name. But anyway, we're going to be talking about STEM. And Mr. Pruitt, I was catching you on YouTube last night, so I'm really looking forward to your presentation today. So he's here to talk to us about STEM standards, and this was after a conversation I had with Peter Lindstrom, who's the executive director of SciMath Minnesota, and I believe Mr. Richard Hudson, who's the board chair of SciMath Minnesota, is here to testify as well and to introduce Mr. Pruitt. So let me welcome you gentlemen both to the committee. You're probably pros. The procedure is to introduce yourselves, to put your name on the record, and then proceed with your testimony. I'm thinking about 30 minutes to hear from you, and hopefully have a little bit of time for some questions as well. Welcome to Minnesota, Mr. Pruitt.
Thank you.
Great. Thank you for the opportunity. I'm Dr. Richard Hudson, the chair of SciMath Min, and in my other job, director of science production at TPT. I've been a member of SciMath Min for over a decade and chair of the last three. And as I think you all know, SciMath Min is Minnesota's statewide coalition for standards-based improvements in pre-K-16 STEM education. And I'm pleased to be able to say the organization celebrates its 20th anniversary this year. SciMath Min is led by a board of directors whose members reflect the strategic nature of the organization, including leaders in education, business, and government. And we work very hard to bring together the interests of all three to be an unbiased, nonpartisan source for the best information to improve STEM education in Minnesota. We've made many contributions to STEM education over the last 20 years. We've brought together these stakeholders for statewide conferences. We've supported a great deal of teacher professional development that has improved the ability of teachers We have provided balanced current research, and you may be aware of some of the work we've done with the TIMSS studies, the Trends in International Math and Science, where Minnesota was tested as if it were a standalone country, and we supported the analysis of those results so we could share them with the stakeholders. Then, to help teachers translate science and math education into effective instruction, we published a volume of frameworks in 1998 and most recently put a new generation of these frameworks online. And you can find these at SciMathMin, and I learned at breakfast that Dr. Pruitt referenced these in some of the initiatives he's doing. I personally think these may be the state of the art for online frameworks. And I have to throw a vote of thanks to MDE working with us to make those happen. SciMathMin has also launched a new statewide initiative you may have heard of, the Minnesota STEM Network. This is an initiative of SciMathMin, now in its fourth year, to connect STEM stakeholders across the state. We hold an annual STEM Network conference. The next one will be May 15th at St. Catherine University, and we hope some of you will be able to attend. We've also organized STEM Day at the Fair to introduce thousands of families to science on the first day of the State Fair for the past 3 years. So you can find out more about SciMathMin and our initiatives. There is a handout, and you can also see our website at scimathmin.org. This morning, it really is a great pleasure to introduce Stephen, whom I've heard speak on this subject a number of times. He is Vice President for Content Research and Development for ACHIEVE. And ACHIEVE is an organization that is leading 26 states, including Minnesota, in developing the next generation science standards. For some context, just so we understand the Minnesota framing of this, we do have a process for standards in the state that includes the establishment of a standards committee and significant public input. For math, the most recent review was in 2007. The next revision is in 2015 and 16. For science, the current standards were revised in 2009 and are scheduled for the next revision in 2017-18. And at that point, we could certainly consider the adoption of these new standards. I think you'll discover that they will really move both STEM teaching and learning ahead, not only in Minnesota, but in the United States. So with that, I'm very happy to welcome Stephen.
Thank you.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you very much. Good morning. I will up front tell you that I am from Georgia. Not that you would have to listen to me very long to figure out that I was from a little south of here. And I'm impressed that you watch me on YouTube. I just hope that you didn't think that you had a bandwidth problem with hearing this. I'm very happy to be here in the beautiful state of Minnesota. I've actually only had the chance to be here one other time. So it's really a gorgeous, gorgeous state, and I've really enjoyed my short time. Apparently, I am going ice fishing tonight.
You make a real Minnesotan out of it.
Yes, yeah. So I'm looking forward to it. So as he said, I am from an organization known as ACHIEVE. ACHIEVE is an organization that was put together by the nation's governors and business leaders back in 96 to support the improvement of education through education reform, in particular with a focus on supporting states through the American Diploma Project to increase the rigor of state standards, graduation policies. I joined there in 2010 after spending 8 years at the Georgia Department of Education, where I had several roles, including science supervisor, and finally ending as the chief deputy for the state superintendent. So I had a little bit of experience in having opportunity to speak to legislators like yourselves. So very happy to be here. I want to say on the front end what an incredibly valuable contribution Minnesota has made to this process. This has been something that we had designed to be as all-inclusive as possible. We have 26 states that signed on at the beginning as lead state partners, and Minnesota is one of those states. I'll talk about that a little bit more in a moment. But just an incredible contribution to this whole process from an intellectual perspective as well as the practical and political perspectives. So with that, I want to walk through just a little bit of the process that's gone on so far and then where we will go beyond here. As some of you may be aware, back in the 90s, there were two significant documents that were developed by the National Research Council and the American Association for Advancement of Science. And those two documents shaped science education reform going forward. Both of these documents were developed to guide states in the development of their standards. But there was a little bit of a hiccup here. You had two documents representing the two different voices in the scientific community. And then on top of that, you had the 50 states who took those two documents and developed their own state standards. As a result, of course, you end up with 50 different interpretations, and you have, frankly, different states having different levels of expectations for their students. So it really started us down the path of thinking about how science needs to be done in schools. Since then, there's been a great deal of research about how students learn science. So it goes well beyond the idea of just what we think would be good, but actually a significant amount of research around not just what kids do, but how they learn, when they learn, and what the most effective strategies for that learning. So the Carnegie Corporation of New York came out with a document called the Opportunity Equation. In that, they, of course, during this time, the Common Core were beginning to start rolling, and there was a lot of evaluation done about the state of science education in the country. And basically, they put out a call to say it's time. It's time that we really get serious about science education and STEM education and begin to move the ball down the field. In doing so, they funded a two-step process that started with the National Research Council in partnership with the American Association for Advancement of Science, the National Science Teacher Association, and ACHIEVE in developing the K-12 science, the framework for K-12 science education. Now, let me just share with you for just a second why this was an important thing. First of all, remember I said in the top left corner you had two different documents representing the two different voices, but those two voices came together in the framework. That's really important. This may come as a shock to some of you, but we have a few controversial issues in science education. And within that, it was really important to have the science community say, here's the science that kids should know between kindergarten and 12th grade. On top of that, they also needed to lay the vision for where we would go. It was not enough just to say, here's the content, but they also needed to say, as a scientist, this is how we work. So this committee, made up of 18 individuals, I was honored to be a part of that when I was in Georgia. I stepped off the committee when I came to ACHIEVE. That 17 of those committee were incredibly honorable people and incredibly smart people. I say 17 because I was the 18th. I won't put myself in the same category with some of those people. In fact, I was actually working on my dissertation at the time, and it was quite a little bit of a starstruck moment for me to walk into this committee and be sitting with people who I was literally quoting while I was writing my dissertation. So you had science education researchers that were there, but we also had world-renowned scientists. We had two Nobel laureates that sat on the committee. In fact, one of my more embarrassing moments in my life came when, as we were sitting talking about chemistry, I'm a chemist, and the teacher in me kicked in and decided that it was a good time to explain something about atomic structure to Dudley Hirschbeck, who won a Nobel Prize in atomic structure. And just kind of had that moment of, oh my goodness, did I just really do that? And being the wonderful guy that Dudley is, he said, it's okay, Stephen. It was very interesting. Which he may have well patted me on the head and said, you're cute. But he was a very humble, very, very worthwhile gentleman. So our job now as we move into the second phase was to work with the 26 states and take the vision of the framework and the content in the framework and develop student expectations that states could then adopt. you may have heard people in the past say that these two documents up in the top left, you know, that they didn't work. You know, those were failed, and you know, and what I'd like for everybody to know is that's not actually accurate. Did they get us as far as those two documents aspired? Probably not. But for the intent of what they were developed, meaning that they would start to shape science education reform, they did that. The difference with this set of standards is these are meant that for states who choose to do so, because I want to be really clear, this is a state choice. That's for states that choose to adopt, the idea here is that they are able to take these standards and go through an adoption process. So we have had a group of 41 writers that have taken the framework and translated that into student expectations. Their role, you had to have somebody that put the pen to paper, and that was their role. As I mentioned, we had 26 states. Now, here's the interesting thing. When we first started this process, we said, well, hopefully we could have six states that would be willing to go out on this limb with us. There's no federal incentive. There's no, you know, real push to do this from any type of level like that. We hope that we can get six. In fact, when I told people inside my organization that we were going to put this application out to all 50 states, I said, you know, our goal is to have six lead states. And I had people say, do you think you'll have six applications? I mean, Stephen, it's science. That's scary to people. Well, lo and behold, we had 20. Well, that created a whole other problem. How do you send 14 "we regret to inform you" letters to people who are willing to do the things that we've asked them to do? They were asked to put together, at their own expense, a leadership team that was broad-based, that had classroom teachers, practicing scientists, science education researchers, university, career, engineers, all on these teams. They were asked to publicly announce that they were part of the process. So we said, great. All the applications were fantastic. They were well thought out. So we took them all. And then we had states that said, well, if we'd known you were going to take everybody, we would have applied too. So we opened it back up again, and we've ended up with 26. These lead state partners have reviewed drafts of the standards, both privately and publicly. They've submitted feedback to us. John Olson, who has done a fantastic job of leading this for the state of Minnesota, and his colleagues in the other 25 states have come to D.C. after each of the reviews and discussed the feedback and given direction to the writers. So the writers, while taking what the framework gave them, have been very much under the direction of the states. And as the states have given us the direction, we have taken that and moving it forward. In addition, we have tackled some pretty difficult issues at times, both from a structural perspective of the standards, but also the intellectual perspective. And as we continue to move down this path, they are going to continue to have the conversations around the different aspects of what implementation would look like, what its quality look like, and how do we effectively integrate this into an overall STEM agenda. We've had two public reviews. During these two public reviews, each time we've had approximately 200,000 individuals go to the site and review the standards. We've had literally tens of thousands of comments that we have waded through, in addition to the confidential state reviews. And we are nearing the end. Thank goodness. This has been a long time coming. We started the framework back in 2008. And now we've been at this for a couple of years, and we are gradually winding down to our goal is to have this completed and released by the end of March of this year. At that point, states will take that opportunity to review the standards and make decisions about whether they will adopt or not. To be clear, the lead states did not make a commitment to adopt. They made a commitment to consider adoption and to be part of the process. The other part that I'd like for you to hear is, as a side note, the 26 states are not the only states that have been engaged. There's a parallel initiative called the Building Capacity for State Science Education. that has been going on, which has included 43 states that have discussed the framework and discussed the standards. And many of those states are also interested at the end of the day of adopting, but for resource issues or leadership issues, they felt that they weren't at a place that they could be in the lead. This is a quick graphic, so you can see where the lead states are. They are geographically placed across the country. This is where our writing team is from, and if you look, you can see that we have a nice view from across the nation. Minnesota, in addition to being a lead state, also has a writer on the team, Mary Coulson, who teaches middle school earth science, is a member of the team. And also we've had significant influence from our higher ed community. Susan Singer from Charlton College has been a significant contributor as we have moved through this process and has really helped us consider the college and career ready aspects of this. So at the end of the day, I want to tell you that there are a couple things to know about the NGSS. First being that this is about preparing students for life after school. It is about preparing them for post-secondary, whatever that post-secondary may be. We have been working with a group of 150 individuals who represent four-year universities, two-year colleges, technical colleges, hiring managers from employers, in thinking about what does this mean for college and career readiness. It's a little bit different definition than what we had in math and English. In math and English, you may know that the definition meant that a student can go directly into credit-bearing coursework without going through remediation. In science, however, we don't really have remedial courses at the collegiate level. Generally, if I decide I want to take organic chemistry, even though I've never had any chemistry in my life, they'll say, sure, go right ahead. Laugh at you while they take the check, but sure, go ahead. But we have such an issue with students not ever getting there. Or they start and then they drop out. We also recognize that the way we have traditionally tried to fill the STEM pipeline is not working, because we have unfortunately had a limited input into that STEM pipeline. So the other opportunity for us here is to recognize that this is for all kids. I think unlike what we've seen in other historic efforts, as great as our country did when we focused on supporting students or supporting math and science reform after Sputnik, the culture of the 60s really focused on a very narrow set of individuals. And this is really about developing all students so that they have a choice of what they do. Not that an adult made a decision, well, you're not good at this. It's actually interesting that in science and math education, it's one of the few things in the world we actually have somehow rationalized that we can help kids get better at things by doing it less. Have you ever thought about that? I don't know of a golfer that could ever get better by playing less golf. But yet, if a child is not good at math, we say, well, we're going to put you in a slower math. We're going to put you don't have to do as much math, and we'll somehow bring you up. And the same happens in science. So we actually have a whole chapter that we've developed called All Standards, All Students. And that is so that we can really have a focus and on the front end think about this, not as an afterthought. But you'll see in that document where we've really given a lot of time and effort to thinking about the research, but also practical instructional support for how to help students with disabilities, English language learning, gifted and talented, how do we engage the gender gap and have more females and more students of color into the STEM pipeline. So just very briefly, because I know that I'm running out of time, we have...
Dr. Pruitt, we're about halfway through the 30-minute mark, just so you get a sense.
Great.
I mean, this is obviously a conversation that could be hours and should be hours long. It's just the constraints of legislative committee time.
No, believe me, I totally understand. I appreciate that. And I'm wanting to get through it so that you guys have plenty of time to ask questions if you'd like. But one thing that I always like to point out just very briefly is this is going to require a conceptual shift from where we currently are. First of all, the way we currently do school science, which is not indicative of how we actually do science, these standards need to reflect the way science occurs in the workplace and how science knowledge is accumulated and communicated. And what that means is that currently if you walk into most science classrooms and you look, pick up the textbook, you see that chapter one is the scientific method, or the scientific method, as I call it, because it's a myth. No scientist actually follows in order the way we have it laid out in most textbooks. You'll never see a scientist that walks in and goes, today I think I will develop a problem. Then I will write a hypothesis. Then I will construct an investigation. All this is something that is a constantly iterative process. And so the standards needed to reflect that real-world connection. Another part that people have to get used to is that standards are not curriculum. Standards are the threshold. They are the where students should be able to perform at the end of instruction. They should guide instruction, certainly, but they should not dictate exactly the day-to-day activities that students do. They also should build coherently over time. Unfortunately, school science often I refer to as lemony snicket science. Any of you who have small children who have read A Series of Unfortunate Events, that tends to be how we also teach science. Kids do not see connections. They don't see how things actually connect to things. So it's a series of unfortunate events. Our goal is that when a student walks metaphorically across the stage of graduation, they look back and they can see a story that was developed from kindergarten of how science actually fits together, that it's coherent. They also focus on deeper understanding of content as well as application of content. So memorizing things is not enough. These standards actually promote the how and the why. In this country, I've read different statistics, but I've read that approximately 80% of our country knows that the moon revolves around the earth and the earth revolves around the sun. But if you ask people to explain how they know that, that drops to 49%. How do we know that Venus is between us and the sun? Well, a few years ago, Venus passed between us and the sun. So these standards actually are moving us more toward the hows and the whys than just simply the memorization. Now, just to be clear, there is very strong requirements for rigor here. The level of content is in most states, I think, is a vast improvement. But it also is the application of that content that requires a greater cognitive demand. Science and engineering are integrated in the NGSS. This is another new thing. Now, not in Minnesota. In Minnesota, you guys have done this for a long time, but for most of our states, the actual integration of engineering and talking about trade-offs and constraints and building and designs it will be a very new thing. Content is also focused on preparing students for the next generation workforce. I get the question a lot, why is earth science still so prominent in high school? Nobody teaches it. But yet Forbes magazine released a study 2 months ago that said that in the next 20 years, two of the top 15 sought-after jobs are going to be earth-based. Geologist is number 5, and petroleum engineer is in the top 10. I think it was number 7. But yet we stopped teaching it after 8th grade. And then, of course, we need to actually have a focused alignment between the math and the English that students are learning so that we don't have science teachers having ill-prepared opportunities to teach their kids. If the math that's needed to explain science is not available, then it actually hurts the ability of the child to learn that science. So the standards are integrating science and engineering practice, disciplinary core ideas, and cross-cutting concepts. Science and engineering practices they're not just teaching strategies. These are actually outcomes. This is how scientists accumulate knowledge and communicate that knowledge. They ask questions. They construct models. They construct explanations. They develop arguments. Disciplinary core ideas is the content. And then cross-cutting concepts are the things that really bind together the sciences. When you talk about energy in biology, it's the same energy that you talk about in physics. It's the same energy you talk about in chemistry. But we pretend, for some reason, that they're different. So we have developed these as student performance expectations. This is not something central just to NGSS. This is happening in a lot of different initiatives. And it's NGSS is kind of a convergent point. If you look at the new AP redesign, you see that there's actually, they are doing the same thing. They're combining practice with content. The new PISA 2015 that's being developed right now will be developed using student performance expectations. The vision of and change of undergraduate biology, which has significant influence from Susan Singer, again, a new biology of 21st century. Scientific foundations for future physicians is also going through the same change that will ultimately lead to changes in how physicians are trained and assessed. We know this approach works because there's been years of study. Taking science to school, learning science in informal environments. We know that it leads to greater engagement and ultimately greater understanding. America's Lab Report, which was chaired by Susan, set out for a set of goals to master subject matter, develop scientific reasoning, understand the complexity and ambiguity of empirical work, develop practical skills, and increase the interest in science and science learning. But we also found in that report that most students don't have that opportunity. They simply don't. Now, this is across the country. And what they found when they did their study is in a typical lab practice, like we do it now, for content mastery, no better or no worse than anything else. But yet, when you really integrate practice with content, there's an increased, significant increased mastery of subject matter, scientific reasoning. The traditional stuff, it works a little, but for a special population of kids, typically. But scientific reasoning in this aspect actually makes it a far more sophisticated usage. And then, of course, the big part here is it also increases the interest in science itself. In developing these, this is just a quick overview. You'll see the blue, orange, and green boxes. These are the three dimensions. One thing that's very different with this set of standards is we felt strongly that we did not want teachers to have a lot of guesswork. We didn't want curriculum and assessment developers to guess or to go through the practice that is very common now called unpacking the standards. From our view, to write these standards, we had to pack them. So we just decided to leave the suitcase open and let everybody see what was packed. Some of these practices are going to be quite different. If you look at constructing a model, we have models in our schools now, but they tend to be edible. They tend to, you know, make models of the cell that can be eaten after, and they don't really do anything with those. But actually, a good model can predict phenomena. It can be used to collect data. So to communicate that, what you see in the standards, the KPS1A, B, and C, those are standards. Those are performance expectations. But when you see design and conduct an investigation, what's new about these, and one of the innovations of this design, is in the blue box, we actually define what it means for a kindergartner to design and conduct an investigation. In the orange box, we actually say, here's the concept that kids are responsible for, so the teachers don't have to guess what that is. And then, how does that combine? How do we talk about patterns? How do we talk about cross-cutting concepts, which are a real core to understanding? And at that point, I will, this is my contact information. I'm always happy to answer any questions after this meeting. But I just wanted to give you that very brief overview and then invite you to ask any questions you may have.
Thank you, Dr. Pruitt. I am now doubly impressed by Georgians because I'm looking at the presentation and I'm saying there's no way this brother's going to get through this in 30 minutes, but you did. and so my hat's off to Georgian efficiency. I have a very quick observation and question, and then Representative Erickson has a question. So you've described, and I think it was important, members, what you described was a highly collaborative process toward the development of these standards and the collaboration emanating from the states themselves.
Yes.
And you're obviously speaking to a state legislature, and so this is a constant source of concern for folks like us that we're not having something shoved down our throats, you know, from some highly centralized you know, federal source. So I think it was highly important. And, of course, we're awfully proud of SciMath of Minnesota. We've known for many years the quality of individuals involved, and so it's doubly comforting for us to know that they've played an integral part in this process over the years. And I think you referenced earlier this notion of the integration of science and engineering. And I think I'm correct that when we adopted our latest science, I think that was 2009, right?
Yes.
That the integration of engineering began in Minnesota in those standards. Here's my question, though, and I'm really pleased to see the American the ALR, which is the American
Lab Report
issue, because when I watched you on YouTube, you said something that really caught my ear. In terms of what it takes to drive new opportunities, and you framed it within a systemic analysis, and so in that presentation you talked about the need to change the equilibrium of a system as an important practice, and that the way to change a system's equilibrium is to perturb the system. I actually wrote this down. So people write down what you say. And that perturb, another way to say that is to create stress within the system. Mm-hmm. And you were speaking in my heart, you know, particularly, and I suspect all of us here, particularly as we continue to struggle with the inequitable academic outcomes that we face in our state and our nation, primarily along racial lines. And the sense, deep sense, that that perhaps nothing short of perturbing, creating stress within the system is going to help to change that around. The issue that I think many of us struggle with, however, and this is folding back to the American Lab Report, is that many of us have suspected that stress has almost exclusively fallen on the backs of students. And so one of the things we're wrestling with this year is the use of high-stakes testing, mm-hmm. Which raises all sorts of equity issues. And frankly, the high-stakes testing also being applied to teachers.
Mm-hmm.
And so maybe if you can just say a little bit about the importance of being very intentional about supporting students and not just simply creating stress within the system, and sort of students they're the ones who really take the stress.
Well, and when I talk about perturbing the system, I talk about it so that the overall outcome is that the students are better off. And unfortunately, I think you're right. I think that there does tend to be that stress. And I think part of that stress sometimes is the fact that you know, science really can be the great equalizer. I mean, it really can engage students regardless of their background, regardless of their previous knowledge. It can engage them in such a way that they see where it fits in their life. And as we go through this, one of the things that we've tried to be very, very clear about is this does not need to be an initiative that is taken lightly or quickly. It needs to be thoughtful and deliberate. Some states are going to be more ready at different times than others, but the capacity building to get prepared for this type of standard is a real tangible need. We can't just roll these out. We can't adopt them one year and just roll them out to say, okay, gang, we know that you were never trained this way when you were in college, but we hope that you do okay with it. There needs to be a real capacity building, and from what I know of the Minnesota Department of Ed and their initiatives in partnership with I always forget your SciMath Men.
Funny little acronym.
I get the men and the math mixed up. they, you know, what I've seen them do already in getting prepared, they're already having conversations about practices. They're already ingraining that through their math science partnership programs, through the different professional development. So not that they're committing to adopt, I want to be real clear, but they also recognize that the research behind why kids learn this has to be something that we first prepare our teachers and administrators to be able to do so that the kids, it doesn't just fall on the kids. You know, it's not sink or swim here. This is, we best help kids by helping our teachers and helping our administrators. And you guys have an incredible network to already be able to facilitate that. The other part that I want to just kind of somewhat tangentially mention is that this also should open doors for incredible levels of collegial support. So we integrate engineering here, but to be clear, this is not full-blown engineering as we see in career tech ed, but it does give the opportunity for a great partnership to happen between the different organizations and the different teachers, so that we don't just teach science on one hall and CTE on another hall. We don't just teach science here and math here. It actually opens opportunities for us to teach whole students instead of pieces of students. I think that's another place where it falls on the kid, is they don't see that full picture, and so when they go across that graduation platform, they're not really prepared because they've only seen pieces. They've not seen the full picture. So this is definitely meant to perturb the system, to put that stress on the system, but I think the real strength of this LEAD State initiative that we've had is I don't think any state feels that they're going to be able to adopt these this spring and turn around and adopt them in the fall. I think most states are saying, you know what, this is going to take a while, and we need to support one another as we move forward with that.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. We have a question from our LEAD, Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you very much for having this presentation. Thank you, gentlemen, for being here, and I hope to see you, Mr. Pruitt, later this afternoon to ask you some questions. Before I do ask my question, I want to note that we have two FFA groups in the audience, one from Foley, who I used to represent, and one from Buffalo, and they're in the audience. And I bring this up not just to recognize them, but Mr. Pruitt, last year and the year before in our educational reform, we have now allowed the earning of a science credit in career technical.
Mm-hmm.
And so I would like you to comment on that, and I think you just affirmed it perhaps in what you just said about not piecing but doing the whole child as far as science, engineering, and math and technology are concerned. So would you comment on to what extent, because I'm hoping these young people are knowing, and I know their teachers do, that they can earn a science credit through their career and technical, which is often courses that our FFA members do take. So please, would you respond?
Absolutely.
Great question. Thank you.
And I'll actually start it by saying, as you can imagine, in Georgia, our ag community is quite strong as well. And we actually did a similar thing. We required 4 years of science in Georgia, and one of those science credits could be earned through our career tech. We kind of went a little bit of a different step, though, in that there's a list of courses that are specific that can be done, and those courses were co-designed with our university faculty, our technical college faculty, and K-12 teachers, because we also wanted to, it was a big deal in Georgia to make sure that, you know, our universities actually accepted those as science credits as well. So we actually are very proud of that. In fact, I would say that if you ask me what some of my more proud things that we did in Georgia, it was actually really having a very strong message about the importance of the alignment between traditional academia and our career tech. This set of standards, because it's not prescriptive, and because it, you know, I'll hear people say, oh, you left out such and such. Because it's really at the core knowledge and a core concept that needs to be learned, it allows the lens to change. So in other words, you know, as a chemist, which is what I was, or am, you know, I could get in and I could talk about, you know, formulas, and I could talk about chemical reactions, and I could talk about, you know, how did these reactions occur mathematically and so forth. But, you know, for a lot of my kids, that wasn't as important as perhaps helping them understand what the acid base or what the pH of soil will do to their crops. Being able to, it's still a concept, understanding how, you know, when you put lime down, it changes the pH of your soil. Well, that's a chemical reaction. So it makes it more hands-on, but it also makes it more practical and useful. And I think that what you hear sometimes with people who are negative about the standards is they want to see that traditional academic list of facts.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and memorizing the order of planets is not really that helpful at the end of the day, right? And so it's maybe a long way to answer your question, but what we feel when we look at these standards is we see an incredible opportunity to rethink school and to rethink how we really support kids when they graduate and become contributing members of society.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One follow-up.
Mr.
Pruitt, we do leave the local districts as the decision makers as to whether or not the standards from our science standards are embedded. Mm-hmm. And so that is a local decision, mm-hmm. and we're proud that they can make that decision. I have one other question for you, though, about high-stakes testing, because as you heard the chair say, we're in the midst of a debate about keeping or changing our grad tests. To what extent is it important, though, that as we look at our future, and our future is so centered on STEM, science, technology, engineering, and math, if we're going to be globally competitive, to what extent is a high-stakes test or something of that nature important to the future of not only Minnesota but the United States?
Dr. Pruitt.
Oh, it's fine. Well, that's a pretty heavy question.
Yes, it is. you noticed everyone sat up.
Yes, I noticed that. And I wanted to slump down. No, I'm just kidding. So, speaking personally, mm-hmm. okay, I want to make that really clear. Speaking personally, I think good assessments that test what's intentioned by the learning, I think have a role to play. I think that what one of the things that we have seen is that if you know things are not assessed, they may or may not be taught.
Mm-hmm.
For me, it's a bit of an equity issue because if you're not assessed, it's easy for you to say, well, we're going to do less with you because you're poor or because you come from this zip code or because you're this or that, you know, and the assessment actually allows for there to be a quality check on the level of instruction. And so for me personally, I think that assessment can be good. But I will quickly also follow it up with, we don't have a whole lot of those at this point. I think that we have a great opportunity with what's going on with Smarter Balanced in part to really change how assessment is done. I mean, teachers test their kids all the time. All of us went through tests.
Mm-hmm.
But the difference is that some of us went through better tests because we were required to do something with that, as opposed to bubble, you know, ABC, or and there are actually tests that can do that well, but for this set of standards in particular, just bubble tests won't work. There's got to be a change in how we do that. In fact, the National Research Council right now has a committee on the Board on Testing and Assessment that will be releasing a study on how to assess this type of standard, probably within several months of the release of the actual standards themselves, because we recognize that there's got to be a change. So I think that there's some benefit to it. I think that it's a way to ensure that that all kids are having access, but I also think that for it to really be effective, we've got to change how we do it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And actually be maybe even a little bit more innovative than what we've been.
Thank you, Dr. Bruin. Thank you, Representative Erickson. Those questions were very much on the top of my mind as well. Members, we do have a bill before us. Here's what the chair is going to do. We have some folks who have traveled a distance to come and testify on that bill, and I want to be able to honor the fact that they did that. I think what's going to happen here, just so you know how I'm going to proceed, is we're probably not going to get to a vote on that bill today, but I do want to at least get the testimony from those folks who have traveled the distance on the bill, so we will have the bill before us. Frankly, I would love to have this conversation continue for hours. what I'm going to do is ask, we have a long list of folks who have questions. I'm going to ask my vice chair to ask her question. And then at that point, I'm going to move us over to the bill. And as I said, the goal is to at least get through the testimony of those individuals who have traveled from greater Minnesota on that bill. Why don't we proceed, Representative Bradner?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll be very quick because you've actually hinted in the direction I was going to go. I'm looking at your list of conceptual shifts. And the point or the question I wanted to raise is, can't these all be applied across the board to almost every subject area our students engage? And aren't their skills going to be improved through applied learning, through integration of, you know, just the whole methodology that challenges curriculum to be relevant to how learning is experienced in the real world? And I think that's a shift we're engaging in now, and I think our whole assessment system is really challenged by that shift, and you've indicated that. So if you have any further comment, I'd welcome it, but I'd also love to have a further conversation with you about that.
I would be happy to. The nice thing about those shifts is, you know, some of them came from the NRC, but many of them really bubbled up organically from the states. You know, the states would say, you need to make sure people know about this. You know, John in Minnesota were particularly strong about making sure that engineering was very prominent. But also this idea about the application of knowledge. They could be applied across the board. I think the issue in science is that, unfortunately, we reduced much of science to use the education language, we reduced it to a word wall many years ago. That it became a list of words and a list of things to be memorized. And, I have two kids, and it just kills me when my daughter comes home and says, oh, I just hated science today. And it's because, you know, they are, you know, there's this list of words that they have to look up. And I always will remember the one teacher that told me a story when I was back in Georgia that a colleague of hers had given their kids this list of words to find the definitions for. They looked them up in the glossary, they turned them in, but this one student did not have their book that day, so they said, go get one out of the back, and it meant so little to them, they picked up the Spanish version of the book and never even paid attention to the fact it was not in their language and wrote the definitions and turned it in. And the kid was not being a smart aleck. The kid literally was checking the box, I've done it. And we have got to get away from that. This application of knowledge is critical. And you'll have people who are the old guard who still believe there's a set of things that you just have to memorize. But what we know from learning research is, I mean, I still, after I've not been in the classroom in 10 years, my son's in AP chemistry, and he will text me when I'm away and say, what's the molar mass of, or the atomic mass of what, whatever? I can still tell them. You know, I still know the atomic mass of iodine, 127.9. I didn't sit and memorize that. I used it because I was a chemist. And so we know so much more. So, yes, I absolutely would 100% agree that those shifts can be across the board. But in science, I just think they're particularly important because it really is a difference in how we've treated science through the last 20 years.
You know, Dr. Pruitt, as you were speaking, I was thinking of my son, who's a senior in high school, and whose his strongest course is in chemistry. He has no interest of going into chemistry. He has a strong interest in economics, social, entrepreneurial, very much an activist. He's a very activist as a young man. And I've encouraged him consistently to think about what science can be for him as mm-hmm. an activist, mm-hmm. as an engaged citizen. And the thought I have as you were speaking is, unless we really focus increasingly on this nexus of practice and content, and we began our session this year by, as members know, having the discussion with Iredale High School, which was an early college model that has a heavy infusion of both content and practice, for students. The thought I have is that, and I suspect this is what keeps you up at night as well, is if you use my son's story, perhaps, how much we're letting just go by and not tapping by not creating the kind of structure that facilitates, you know, that combination of those interests and those aptitudes to create God knows what, you know, that can make our society better. I really want to thank you for your testimony to today, for taking time to be with us. Thank you, SciMath, for helping us tap into this national knowledge base, and thank you for the work that you've been about, and I look forward to our continued association.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right. With that, members, I'm going to ask Representative Newton to come forward to present House File 261. And as he comes forward, here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to have Representative Newton explain House File 261, and then this is going to be a little weird, but I'm going to ask Mr. Kavanaugh, Mr. Thompson, and Mr. Magnoli to follow immediately, because those are the community of interest that are traveling from a distance here today. What's odd about that is that they're opposed to Representative Newton's bill, and typically you have the proponents go first, but I don't want to rush our visitors from our fellow citizens from Greater Minnesota from not testifying. And then I'll revert back to Mr. Kroonquist, Mr. Superintendent Dressen, and Board Member Malone, and hopefully we can at least get the testimony in. And if we're not able to get to a vote by 11:30, I'll move the latest over, and then we'll take the bill up again at our next committee hearing. So with that, Representative Newton, and I'm going to move for you that House File 261 be recommended to pass and referred to the floor of the House.
Thank you, Chair Mariani and members of the committee. I'll try to be brief also. This bill is about local control. It's about restoring to the school boards the authority to start to decide when they want to start the school year, when they want to end the school year. Our starting date after Labor Day was initially set up to accommodate the Agrarian Society, and Minnesota, as you know, has shifted over the years, and we just haven't kept up with our state statutes in terms of the school calendar. I had the good fortune of teaching some classes at Anoka Ramsey and had quite a few PSEO students. And those students, when they came in our fall semester, started class at Anoka Ramsey on the 21st or 22nd of August. They didn't start school until after Labor Day. So a lot of the support staff from the school wasn't there to be able to assist them with questions that they had, so we tried to work through that. But I just want to show that, you know, there are other things that are going on with our high school students in addition to the start date for the schools. This bill has a strong support of the business community, of the Minnesota Business Partnership. So, and even though I know it's going to be opposed by resort owners and people that rely on the trade during the summer months, it does have the general support of the Minnesota Business Partnership. So with that, Mr. Chair, I would like to have the testifiers come down and maybe we can get this through this morning.
You never know. So let me ask Mr. Tom Kavanaugh, who I had the pleasure of meeting at the beginning of the meeting, to come down, and Mr. Dave Thompson. And I think Mr. Magnoli should probably be on deck as well. Good morning.
Yeah. Good morning.
Welcome to the committee, Mr. Kavanaugh. If you could just state your name for the record and then proceed with your testimony.
Yes, my name is Tom Kavanaugh. Mr. Chair, thank you. And committee members, thank you for having us. My name is Tom Kavanaugh, and I, along with three of my brothers, own and operate Kavanaugh Sylvan Lake Resort in the Brainerd Lakes area, about 2 hours north of the Twin Cities here. So I'm not that terribly far away. But thank you for moving it along.
You're a little bit farther away than I am.
I'm actually a Timberwolves season ticket holder, of all things, and so I make a lot of trips.
Well, let's talk afterwards.
Yeah. Cry on each other's shoulder. My parents purchased our resort in 1969, and the second generation has had full ownership of our property since 1992. We're hoping that a third generation will carry on there as well. Of course, that gets a little bit more and more difficult in our industry all the time. We're seeing more and a higher cost of permitting, higher taxes, and sometimes difficult shoreline regulations. However, I will say this, that at least we have always had the summer to work with. Yet year after year, it seems that we need to fight about this issue regarding the traditional summer. While we operate a year-round business, we in fact do about 70% of our business during a 10-week stretch of the summer, from June 15th to Labor Day. 70%. We're lucky. The vast majority of resort properties in the state open only during the summer and do nearly 100% of their business during that time. To you and to this entire committee, many in the legislature, you might say, what difference does it make to eliminate 1 week of the summer vacation season? Well, it's not just that week. In fact, it pushes everything back. Because of the fall sports schedule starting 2 weeks or sometimes more sooner before school, we now have affected the entire month of August. Imagine, if you will, taking one-third of your income and someone saying, sorry, but you're going to have to lose 15 to 20% of that third. That's what pre-Labor Day school start would do to my family business and to my many friends in the resort business. But not just resorts. It's to summer rental companies, small locally owned retailers that depend on summer traffic, restaurants in those areas, and so many other businesses. For our resort, the impact would be significant. Would it put us out of business? Well, no, it wouldn't. But I do believe that there are resorts that would go out of business over time because of it. But it doesn't just affect us as a business owner. It would also have a negative impact on employment, and I would say especially on those high school students who depend on the resort business for a lot of seasonal work. It would affect the consumer. Obviously, we have to try to pick up some of that lost revenue somewhere, which would, in essence, mean higher prices. It would affect tax revenue, the same tax revenue that helps our schools. Let me be very clear with all of you that I and my family passionately support schools. I, as a board member of Hospitality Minnesota's Education Foundation, volunteer countless hours in working with our ProStart Culinary Program for high school students throughout the state, and also setting up hospitality management programs at schools throughout the state. That education program this year will award $70,000 in scholarships to students going into the hospitality business. I was a high school girls basketball coach for 12 years. I directed 3 high school one-act plays, never won. I and my wife graduated from the public school in Pillager, Minnesota, as did 2 daughters and 17 nieces and nephews. Our resort and our 2 neighboring resorts are the 3 largest taxpayers in that school district. Resorts supporting schools. We support schools, and our industry supports schools. And we would support a change if there was proof that it made a difference, but there isn't. The issue, ladies and gentlemen, is a predictable school year. A predictable school year is something we've had for 150 years in Minnesota, and the entire infrastructure, and this is really, really important, the entire infrastructure of the resort industry and tourism in general have been built on that predictable school year. This is a school year that in a statewide Minnesota Center research poll showed that 75.6% of Minnesotans believe that K through 12 students should not start school before Labor Day. If you as lawmakers are willing to have a negative impact on the tourism industry, if you're willing to cause a loss of business and businesses, if you're willing to change and willing to lose tax revenue as well as change tradition and harm the job-producing industry, and let me assure you that it will have that effect. Well, then I guess pre-Labor Day school question is an easy one for you. But if you want to continue to grow our tourism industry, you want to increase jobs, increase tax revenue, and save tradition, then keep our traditional summer in place. In fact, I would implore you to keep the summer tradition in place. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Kavanaugh. Thank you for your concise statement as well. And I believe this is Mr. Thompson.
Yep.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the
record. Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Dave Thompson. My wife and I own a resort in the Battle Lake area, which is in Representative Nornes's district. We've owned it for 23 years. I am here also representing the Congress of Minnesota Resorts, which is an organization that has around 200 small family-owned resorts, and I would echo pretty much everything that Mr. Kavanaugh said. I won't repeat all that sort of thing because he said it as well or better than I could. What I would like to add is that, like Mr. Kavanaugh said, many of our current resort owners, future or resort owners, and past resort owners have served on school boards. We are very involved in our local communities. Our kids and grandkids go to those schools, so the education is very important. Our resort association also provides several scholarships per year to kids from our membership so that they can go to school and hopefully come back and serve in the hospitality industry. The hospitality industry in Minnesota, north of what I would say Highway 210, from what I heard from another a senator in the northern area, said that the most important things in that area of Minnesota is taconite, timber, and tourism. And certainly tourism is huge in most of these small communities. Why is that important to central Minnesota? My business, myself, I went and looked at my accounting for my business, and I spend 92% of my income in Minnesota. And most of that I spend either in my local community or in the metro area where I have to buy hospitality supplies from suppliers down here. So that all creates jobs. My customers, when they come, they have to, if they're coming from Iowa, Illinois, Wisconsin, they have to drive through the metro area to get here, get to my location to vacation. So they're stopping at restaurants, they're buying things, they're supporting the economy here. All we as resort owners heard during past elections was that you want to create jobs. Well, we already have and provide tremendous amount of jobs in rural Minnesota, and by changing the dates when people traditionally go on vacation, it severely impacts our business. You could come to my resort after the first week in August and you will not find one family that has school-age kids from outside of Minnesota. I have zero customers at my resort from after the first week in August that will come from another state because they're all starting school early. And I don't have any of those families starting to come to my resort prior to the first week in June either because they don't get out of school until well after Memorial Day. That's all I wanted to say, and I thank you for your time.
Thank you. And I'm wondering, maybe this might be a good time to stop and ask for questions, because Mr. Magnoli, you're not speaking to the resort issue, I don't believe.
Mr. Chair, correct.
Right, and so just on the resort issue, it might be a good moment, but don't go away, Mr. Magnoli. Representative Nornes.
Mr. Chair, I strongly oppose this legislation, but I was just going to ask a question more weather-related than anything, but it seems to me the early part of the summer is probably the most unpredictable and unsettled as far as weather is concerned. And when you get into August, it seems like it's settled, and it's a much more attractive time to plan a vacation. I don't know if that's true or not, but it seems to me that's a factor. And so when you have some of the best weather for a vacation, and now we kind of do this to the resort industry, it just seems to be counterproductive.
Yes.
I don't know if I'm accurate or not, but it's...
It's very true, and you'll note that I pointed out from June 15th to Labor Day, because in our case, the first 2 weeks of June are, as you say, very unpredictable. Some years we have pretty good first 2 weeks of June, but it's so weather related. August, obviously, the lakes are warm. They are maintaining that temperature. It's a great time to travel, and we stay completely full right up until Labor Day weekend.
Can I comment?
Mr. Thompson, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Nornes. I would say that many resorts in Minnesota and tourism businesses that are not resorts, like golf courses and family-oriented activities that are weather-dependent, are certainly more conducive to later on in the summer. However, businesses like mine that are fishing-oriented resorts, from my season really peaks once bass opener starts. I live on a lake that not only is fantastic for walleye fishing, but for the panfish and bass. And my summer really gets started earlier, and then the fishing is exceedingly good in the fall. But families come. The problem I see in our business is that families cannot come and bring young kids anymore because they're in school or they're in school-related sports that start prior to school. And so they don't get to fish with their dads and grandfathers. Their dads and grandfathers, I can market to them and I can bring them up. But part of our workforce goes away when school starts. If you come to our Battle Lake community or Fergus Falls community, you'll find the craft shops, the antique shops, the golf courses all start reducing their hours because their workforce has gone back to school.
Thank you. Any other questions for these gentlemen? Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and to the testifiers. First of all, I like the stressing the fact that even though most of our resorts are in the northern part of the state, that folks from other states pass through southern Minnesota, the non-resort areas as well, using the gas stations and the restaurants and other stores as they're traveling too. So there's an economic benefit really to all of Minnesota. But I would like to wonder, or I do wonder, it's just 1 week, that week before Labor Day. I mean, is that really so important? What difference does 1 week make in a resort community?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If I read this bill correctly, it says that you can start before Labor Day. It doesn't say 1 week. It says anytime. So that, in my opinion, opens it up to year-round school, and that would be devastating for our industry. I have educators that come from Iowa that are year-round school teachers, and they have some kids that are in elementary school. They get their 2 or 3 weeks out on one part of the month, then their kids that are in middle school have a week off or 2 weeks off at a different time, and their high school kids at a different time, and they can't find a time to take a family vacation. When this bill was announced, I had probably 15 calls from metro area customers that called and said, if this bill passes, we're going to have to cancel our reservation this year. I had my first year in the black since 2006, this past summer.
And Representative Erdahl, I do want to hear from others, but just a quick comment, by the way. I think what we'll hear from others is that, and I think we heard it from Mr. Kavanaugh, that most other states don't have this ban, and so the folks coming through are probably not going to be coming through later in the year. That benefit to your local area, I think, is going to be more in those pure summer months. But we'll hear some testimony about where other states stand on this issue. Really quickly, Mr. Representative.
Just a quick comment. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was actually trying to set you up a little bit there. What I was told over the years, teaching in a resort area, which I did do, is that last week for many resorts is the make or break week of the summer. That week before Labor Day is a very important week, and that, as I said, that's where they get into the black.
Thank you. And let me do this now. Mr. Bagnoli, I'm going to put you on hold. And ask our Edina Superintendent, Mr. Superintendent Dressen, and Orono School Board Member John Malone to come down. Thank you, gentlemen, for your testimony. So what I'm trying to do is to make sure at least the folks who aren't here regularly have an opportunity to speak on this issue. It does not look like we're going to get to a vote on this thing, and so I'll be laying this over. There's a long list of questions still, and we'll get Mr. Magnoli's testimony hopefully today, but if not, when we reconvene. Good morning, gentlemen. Welcome.
Good morning.
Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Rick Dressen, Superintendent of Edina Public Schools. And on behalf of Edina Public Schools, I wish to speak in favor of the proposed bill allowing individual schools to have their independence in determining the start of the school year. This position is also supported by the Association of Metropolitan School Districts and the Minnesota Association of School Administrators. Edina, like school districts throughout Minnesota and across the country, are strategically working to reshape, reform, and transform the educational system for our young people to ensure that they are ready for a dynamic and exciting world that lies ahead of them. We recognize schools are not only preparing today's students for the world of the 21st century, but also given the growing life expectancy of the 22nd century. To do this, we need to make many changes in our systems, our practices, our policies, our statutes that place limits on allowing school districts to maximize their available resources of funds, time, talent, facilities, and partnerships. Edina recognizes time as a resource. We know that we are not currently maximizing our time for student learning. We're focused on creating better practices and policies to use time to create blocks of quality learning time within our schools. This is necessary to accomplish our commitment to ensure the success of all of our students through a personalized learning experience. This personalized learning experience must allow learning to occur anytime, any place, on any device, any path, any pace. And I think after listening to this morning's discussion about SciMath, you'll see that this is a commitment not only occurring in Minnesota or in Edina, it's also a movement throughout the nation. Edina believes this is how we'll advance learning for all of our students and be successful for those students and also close our achievement and access gaps. We need to make sure our students are ready to be contributing and productive citizens of the state of Minnesota. As we look at time, we are also assessing school schedules, summer learning, homework practices, teacher training, substitute teacher practices, parent-teacher conference times, teacher workload demands, student assessments, vacation breaks during the school year, and the school year limit. We are not looking at these time challenges in isolation, but rather see them interdependent in both the practicing of time and maximizing the quality of learning during that time. Students have already found this to be true in their online learning, applied learning experiences, and learning beyond the day. Schools are also using creative solutions to offer teachers training beyond time without missing time in front of their students at an instructional level. These are just the start of unlocking time. Edina does believe a quality block of time for learning in our school district is the days before Labor Day, as compared to the days deeper into June. We believe we are not alone in this position and recognize many positive learning outcomes from being able to access this time for our learners. The skills needed for tomorrow's workforce are changing. Schools need the flexibility to adapt to the individual needs of students and this changing workforce needs of our future. Again, one such issue of this is time and how we structure instructional blocks of time to ensure students' success and prepare them for life after high school. And these decisions are to be made at a local level so schools can best meet the individual needs of each and every student. I would urge your support for this bill.
Thank you, Superintendent Dressen. School Board Member John Malone, welcome from the Orono.
Thank you. Yes, I've been on the Orono School Board, Representative Mariani, since 2000, and I've been on the AMSD Board since that time as well. And I'd like to thank you for the opportunity to come here and talk to you about how important this bill is to myself as a school board member. You know, I was struck by, as Mr. Dressen was, the presentation that came before us, and it talked about the ramping up of the rigor, really. And when I came on the board in 2000, we weren't talking about STEM. Maybe 10 or 20% of our students were taking an AP test, and now that number is 60 to 70% and growing every year. The rigor is being ramped up, and we need to be able to change and adapt to embrace that change and to give our students every opportunity to succeed on both the state and on the national level. 2008 survey that I suspect most of you are familiar with by the Minnesota State School Boards Association indicated that if given the choice, 72% of the school districts would opt for a pre-Labor Day start, 28% would opt for a post-Labor Day start. But what I think is most important is that would mean 100% of those school districts would be making a choice that would best foster student achievement in that particular school district. It's all about local choice and local control. As a school board member, I can tell you we struggle to put together the best calendar we can. There are not idle days. People start talking about, well, you have X amount of days between Labor Day and Memorial Day. We struggle to get the best possible calendar, and idle days where we could just plug school in does not exist. You know, the recently approved school board calendar that we, or the school calendar that we approved had 7 days over a span of 9 months that had to take care of all of our parent-teacher conferences, all of our staff development, all of our teacher workshop days. There is not a lot of slack in that schedule. Representative Mariani, you had mentioned that you'd like to hear a little bit about what other states are doing. Well, Minnesota is really only one of three states that require or mandate a post-Labor Day start, and I think that number should really cause us pause. Why are all these other states opting the other way? And it's not like Minnesota is unique in tourism being an essential part of our state's economy. In fact, 29 states require or count tourism as either their first, second, or third major employer in the state. Tourism exists throughout the United States, yet they find a way to embrace a pre-Labor Day start because it's in the best interest of their students. Let me just tell you about two of the other states that do mandate it. Iowa. They mandate a post-Labor Day start, but then they say, well, we'll give us a school district the opportunity for a waiver if there's a reason that they feel that they should start before. Well, guess what? 98% of the school districts in Iowa opt for that waiver. That tells us something right there. In Virginia, which is the other state that mandates a post-Labor Day start, they allow a waiver for any district that can show they might get a little bit of snow or ice in the winter. And that's literally how the statute is phrased. Currently, 79 of the 132 school districts have been able to show that snow or ice may enter their season and that thus may lose some instructional time. Snow days were also the focus of a scholarly article written in Education Next, which I think is very instructive. It was written by a professor from the University of Maryland, Dave Marcotte, and the title of the article was "When the Snow Falls, Test Scores Drop." And he was talking about the variability in test scores based on number of instructional days and loss of days due to snowfall. Professor Marcotte studied Minnesota students' third grade math test scores over a three-year period and concluded there was a substantial year-to-year variation in the number of instructional days students had prior to the test day. Of this test score increase, a large portion was attributable to expansion of test days prior to the test. That's not only statistically documentable, it's intuitive. We kind of know time in school matters. We know that to be true. I think we should honor it and embrace it. Drive by any school parking lot in the last week of August, and that lot is going to be full. And school exists, except we ban students from the classroom. That's what we need to really think through and change. Our teachers are in workshops. Our students are there for sports, they're there for band, they're there for all kinds of co-curricular and extracurricular activities, yet we mandate by state law that they can't be allowed instruction within the school school setting. I would like to just make a couple of points, too, relative to the very well-thought-out and concise testimony on behalf of the resort owners that was given. They mentioned that 76% of the people polled think school should start after Labor Day. What's funny, though, is if you ask people that same question, and this has been done a number of times, a similar number will say, should school districts be given the choice to start before Labor Day or after day, you get the same percentage. It's a choice issue. Minnesota's not unique. Tourism is important throughout this, and state fairs are important throughout this country, too. We can embrace that. We can work with it. Give us the opportunity. Thank you.
Thank you, School Board Member Malone. We have about 2 minutes. Representative Faust, I think, has a question, and then I'm going to move to lay this bill over for until we. I'll lay it over, and the intent would be to take it back up when we reconvene because I think we want to have some further discussion as well. Representative Falls.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. I have a first a rhetorical question and then a real question. So
quick
first,
ones, Representative Falls.
last committee hearing, we heard that Minnesota is doing so well compared to other states. We were in the top five in just about every category we discussed. And if we're one of only two states that won't allow classroom before Labor Day, maybe the other 48 states should change to be like us instead of us to change like them if our scores are actually doing better. So, but my real question is, why is a day in August so much better than a day in June?
So I would say we're looking at, excuse me, Mr. Chair, thank you, and Representative. I would say the reason is the quality. Again, if you take a look at what's happening in that second week of June, if you go into a classroom, you'll see the energy isn't there, and there's a readiness in August. In Edina, we believe it's very important that there's a readiness for that learning, and so that's why we see the quality of time available that week prior to Labor Day is much stronger than that second week in June. And so we're looking at blocks of time. We think it's a better quality of time for learning.
I would agree with that, and I would also add that the high-stakes testing that is now so much a part of our school curriculum, a lot of those tests, the Minnesota State Comprehensive Tests, are taking place earlier and earlier in the school year, as are the AP tests. More and more of our students are taking AP tests. The more instructional time we can get before this high-stake testing, the better off we are.
Members, that's unfortunately all the time that we have. Gentlemen, thank you so much for your testimony and for being here today. Thank all the testifiers. We will take this up again when we reconvene, and so the chair will lay over House File 261. And until next week, we stand adjourned. Thank you.